Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. Craig, recently, while he was taking one of his sons up to law school at UF, was driving along I-75, as you do, to get there from St. Pete, and called up a former governor of this state.
Well, not while driving. Let me make that clear. But I passed, for some reason, the routing technology on our way back home sent us past three landmarks. One was Paynes Prairie Preserve State Park, where they have buffalo, by the way. Yep. It's the only place in Florida where they have a herd of buffalo. The notorious Cafe Risque strip joint, which has billboards all up and down the state. And a place that claims it has more fireworks for sale than anywhere else in Florida. And I thought, well, that's kind of a Florida trifecta right there. You know? The buffalo, the strip joint, and the and the fireworks. But thinking back, I camped at Paynes Prairie once with my kids' Boy Scout troop, and it was fantastic. It was pitch black out there in the campgrounds, and we could see the stars, you know, almost like they were, you know, almost like we were in space with the stars. It was so dark. And I thought to myself, you know, how many state legislators have gone camping at a place like that? How many of them have even set foot in any of our state parks? And that sort of led me to writing a column where I wrote about, you know, we've got these mythical creatures in Florida. We've got the skunk ape. We've got the mermaids at Wekiwatchee Springs. And we've got lots of politicians who claim they love the environment.
Yeah.
Do they really? And so I kind of went back through the roll, called the roll of various governors, and wound up, I went up on the phone with Gwen Graham, the former congresswoman from the Panhandle and daughter of former governor and Senator Bob Graham. And she was telling me about how when he was governor, he would take the family out on these excursions. They'd go to the beach. They'd go out to Stiltsville off Miami, which we should do a show on at some point. They went paddling the Suwannee River. She said they took a houseboat trip to the Everglades that still lives in memory because it was during a time of maximum mosquito penetration. And I said, do you think those experiences of being out in nature influenced his policy decisions? She said, well, why don't you ask him that? And she handed the phone to her dad.
Great story.
I know. So I asked him and he said, yes, absolutely. Because, you know, if you're out in nature, if you see that nature, you feel a personal connection to it and you want to protect it. And so in my column, I was kind of suggesting that that's the problem. We keep electing people who don't have a personal connection to Florida's nature. They don't get it at that level, at that personal level of,
yeah,
I've been to a state park, I've been to the beach and seen, you know, the damage that oil can do or something like that. And so for them, it's not real. It's just an abstract thing. And we who do enjoy Florida's outdoors, we enjoy, you know, fishing and that kind of thing. Why don't we elect people like us? Why don't we elect people who share our values?
Yeah.
And instead of people who are willing to take campaign contributions from polluters and do what they want.
It's a great point, and one you've made numerous times here on the podcast. When you look at Ron DeSantis, when you look at Rick Scott, when you look at a lot of the people that we elect, they are much more comfortable schmoozing with developers in a boardroom than they are on a hike or bird watching or with their jeans rolled up to the knees because they're walking through muck. And to those people, like you just mentioned, nature is sort of like a perk, an add-on, a bonus. It's kind of like heated seats in a car. You know, you'd never not buy or buy a car because it's like this nice thing. To the rest of us, it's an essential. It's the windshield. Yeah. It's the steering wheel.
It's the reason we live here.
Absolutely, 100%. And we do not elect people, oftentimes because there's no one running who fits that mold. But yes, like you said, and the point of the column, and you can read it at floridaphoenix.com, is, you know, we elect people and typically have representing us people who look at the environment as sort of extra.
It's a special interest. They regard it as a special interest, and it's not. It's an essential interest.
I could not agree any more with you, and keep that in mind when you're thinking about voting or maybe even running for office yourself. And that doesn't have to be for governor. That might be for county commission or your planning board or something as small as that. You can make a difference right where you live. And someone making a difference to nature and the environment in Florida is Dr. Kate Mansfield. She runs the UCF Marine Turtle Research Group. turtles. We've had episode on manatees, and we've had episodes on the panthers. Absolutely. One of these, and an upcoming episode on the gopher tortoise. We love talking about these species, which are so representative of Florida, and having those opportunities to make those rare personal connections with those animals. And Kate has done more of that than most of us ever dare to in a life. So let's learn at the knee of Dr. Kate Mansfield here.
This is actually a really good time to talk about sea turtles, isn't it? Because are we in the middle of the sea turtle season, or are we towards the end of it?
About towards the end of it, but the loggerheads are wrapping up, one of the species that we have nesting in Florida, and the green turtles are still nesting. They're going to continue to nest through probably October, but they'll be winding down fairly soon.
When we say nesting, can you describe for people what that means? I've seen it. It's one of the most incredible things I've ever been privileged to witness. But to tell people what we're talking about there.
Sea turtle nesting is fairly extraordinary. I mean, we have these ancient reptiles that crawl up on the beach. Only the females will emerge on our nesting beaches. And in Florida, we see about 90% of all the sea turtle nesting in the Atlantic or the western part of the Atlantic. So Florida gets quite a bit of sea turtle activity. The central Florida region that my lab studies, that's usually, it's like from Patrick Air Force Base, just south of Kennedy Space Center, all the way down to Sebastian Inlet. We see a huge number of nesting turtles in that area. We get about, in the lower 20 kilometers, just part of the Archikar National Wildlife Refuge, we get about 20 to 30% of all the loggerhead and green turtle nesting. So a female loggerhead or green turtle, they usually come ashore after dark. That's part of the reason why we have to keep our beaches really dark during the turtle season, because they can get distracted by condo lights or people on beaches with flashlights. And the females will crawl up the beach. They search around a little bit, maybe for a good spot. They'll dig what's called a body pit, which is pretty much what it sounds like. They kind of move the soft layer of sand off, and then they will start to dig the egg chamber, which when it's done, it looks like the shape of a light bulb. So it's, you know, kind of narrow at the top and bulbous at the bottom. And they use their rear flippers to do this. And, you know, my crew is out there at 2 in the morning, 1 in the morning, watching them do this. And, you know, their rear flippers are really dexterous. It's pretty cool to see from a distance, because they can be spooked up until the time they start dropping eggs. But once they dig that egg chamber, they'll start to drop their eggs 2 to 3 at a time. Once they finish doing that, anywhere from 50 to 150 eggs, it kind of depends upon the individual, they reverse the process. They'll take their rear flippers, take some sand, shove it into the hole that they dug with the eggs, and then eventually kind of knead it down with their rear flippers. And then they'll take their front flippers and start flinging sand back behind them. And that's usually when we get our new interns to sit behind the turtle and kind of watch activities to write a passage on my project. But the turtles that nest, the only time that they fling sand back that far is when they have dropped eggs. So it's a good sign to look for if you're out walking on the beach. To see, you know, whether a turtle nested or not.
Now, I'm here on Amelia Island, and we get a lot of sea turtle nests. And one thing I was not familiar with until moving here was something called a false crawl. So before we leave the egg-laying portion of the podcast, why do false crawls happen?
That's not an archaic term, but it's a term that we use that has just kind of stuck with us. I would argue that it's probably not a false crawl, just because they have a purpose. They're coming up to potentially nest. But a false crawl or a non-emergent crawl happens when a female turtle crawls up and then something happens or the conditions aren't quite right. So she could either be spooked by something. It could be a predator or a person or lights on the beach, or she tries to dig an egg chamber and the sand's too dry. If we haven't had a lot of rain, we'll get a lot of dry sand collapsing. They need to have kind of just the right conditions to have the sand be just kind of damp enough that it sticks where it needs to stick. Or they dig down and they encounter something. They could encounter roots or something that blocks them from digging. They could run into debris on the beach or picnic tables or
pirate treasure. That's a problem.
but when that happens, Kate, they only go up and try once. They don't try a little here, try a little there. You got one spot. If that spot isn't just right, they go back into the water.
They may. There are some that off-road it. They might try to go up into the dunes, find the right spot. Some visit people's lawns, you know, behind the dunes.
Yeah.
Some turtles are tenacious. They might dig a number of body pits or even egg chambers before they give it up and head back. Some turtles have missing rear flippers or partial, you know, rear flippers that are missing, or they have trouble digging. So they might keep trying. But a turtle will probably come back the same night, maybe within an hour or two, and try again. They are, any female that's in a reproductive cycle for a season, she will nest multiple times in that season, usually 3 to 5, maybe 7 times. Wow. And there's a break in between, about a 10-day, 2-week break in between each nest. So when she's ready to nest again, she has kind of a window to try to nest, and she'll keep trying until she's.
Yeah. Well, what you say there blows up a myth I was going to talk about, and this idea that a turtle returns to the same place year after year. And if I'm here at Beach Access 30 on Amelia Island, I can just, you know, set my clock and wait for that same turtle to come back. When people say they nest in the same place year after year, how close are we talking? A mile, a couple miles, 10 miles, same county?
The thing that I find really neat and fascinating about these animals is that they do have really strong fidelity to their nesting beaches. We think it's because they may somehow imprint on the beach as little hatchlings when they're emerging from their egg chambers and crawling down the beach into the water. It's possible that what they're doing is they're imprinting on the Earth's magnetic field. And the kind of signature of the Earth's magnetic field in that nesting area. So we do know that females will come back to the same general region once they're mature, which takes about 20 or 30 years to reach maturity. Wow. Unlike humans who hit puberty at age 11, 12, 13, it takes turtles at least twice as long. Hmm. So they will return to those regions. It may not be, you know, Access 30 on a beach somewhere, but some turtles do have really, really strong fidelity to a particular spot. I've worked on nesting beaches in the Caribbean where a hawksbill, another species that is mostly down in more tropical waters, a hawksbill that was tagged so we could identify it, came back to the same maybe 10 meters of beach the course of 10 years. And, you know, their reproductive cycles, they usually nest every 2 to 3 years. So there's this 2 to 3 year gap, and then they come back and hit the same general area. It's pretty impressive. Some turtles, it might be within a few kilometers, but we do tag our turtles so we can identify individuals, and we do get returns to the beaches that we monitor. So it's pretty cool.
How important is that magnetic connection? Does that affect how they migrate as well?
We think so. The magnetic field is used by a number of species, birds, and I think lobsters, and even salmon. And sea turtles are known to have an innate sense of where they are in the world based on their ability to tap into and somehow sense, and we don't really know how that sense happens, whether it's a visual thing or they have some little nudging, you know, mineral in their head somewhere that might somehow tell them where they need to go. But when hatchlings emerge, they do have this innate sense and a magnetic compass. So when they're swimming in the open ocean during the sea turtle lost years, they generally will orient to stay within waters that will help them survive, waters that are warm enough for them, not head too far north where they might get cold stunned, or head too far south into the South Atlantic where then they're kind of lost to our population. So what we know about turtles and their magnetic compass and their magnetic sense is still kind of limited, but I find it really fascinating. And we think that the females use it to potentially return to the same general area to nest as adults. But how that changes as they grow and age and whether they rely on it more or less, we just don't know.
All right. You dropped a term on us now. Sea turtle lost years. Is this like with kids out of college where they don't have a real career and they're just sort of couch surfing and bumming? Or what are the sea turtle lost years?
Potentially. It would be like the toddler years, maybe. If you just set your toddler loose somewhere and let them go. The sea turtle lost years refers to, and it's a term that's kind of referencing our lack of information about the early life history, the early years of these young turtles. And the time from which they hatch out and crawl into the ocean, they go through this 24 to 48 hour frenzy period where they're burning off the extra yolk energy that they kind of grew around a big yolk in their eggs. And they still have a little bit of that they're burning off. Once that frenzy period winds down, and during that time, they're kind of like the Energizer bunny. They're just like little wind up toys. They keep swimming and swimming. Mm-hmm. It gets them offshore into oceanic or deeper water habitats where there are fewer predators. Potentially, those coastal habitats that we live on have lots of creatures living in them that would love to eat little baby turtles as a snack. So they essentially will move offshore and then they don't show back up again in our coastal waters until at least a couple, if not several years later. Hmm. They leave our coastal habitats and they're about the size of maybe half a deck of cards. So they're really small. And then they return to coastal habitats. Some species are about the size of a cereal bowl or maybe a dinner plate. And then other species may be as large as a toilet seat or, the chair somebody mm-hmm. might be sitting in or something like that. So we know that they spend a considerable amount of time offshore, but because it's offshore, it's a lot harder for us to study an animal in the open ocean. And the turtles are generally too small to be able to satellite tag them until relatively recently. So they're called the lost years because we just don't know a lot about them.
Before we get any further, real quick, what are the species of sea turtles we have here in Florida and a brief description of them?
Well, Florida is known for the loggerheads. Loggerheads are by far most common. They're, as their name suggests, they have a weird head. They have a very large head. They have jaws of death and steel, essentially. They're really strong to bite through clams and conch and all sorts of hard-shelled organisms, plus crabs and horseshoe crabs. Mm-hmm. Green turtles are probably the second most common. These turtles are a little bit larger than loggerheads. They are maybe about half the size of a refrigerator door, add a head and flippers to them. Same with loggerheads, but loggerheads might be a little bit smaller. Green turtles weirdly have a tiny little head in relative to the shell size. They kind of have a pinhead of sorts. They look weird that way, but they are bigger overall. And green turtles are called green because they, as adults and larger, older juveniles, they'll eat mostly a vegetarian diet. So their fatty tissue might turn green, which is why the turtles historically were called green turtles. We also have leatherbacks. Leatherbacks are the largest sea turtle that are out there. They don't nest in as many, in as large numbers as loggerheads and greens in Florida. And they're mostly found on the Atlantic coast, kind of down in the Juneau Beach area, Martin County, and Palm Beach County. We, up in our neck of the woods in Brevard County, we're kind of at that northern extent where they nest. So they don't nest as much up your way, say in Amelia Island or in some other areas. The weirdos that we sometimes have are Kemp's Ridleys. These turtles historically have only nested in the western Gulf of Mexico. So Mexico and Texas, and their numbers have also historically been the most at risk, and they have been deemed like the most critically endangered of sea turtles over the years. They are starting to nest, perhaps again, we don't know, in Florida. So we might have 15 to 20 nests in, throughout Florida for Kemp's Ridleys. They mostly nest during the day. They're also fairly petite, they're small, and when they nest, they do this little, it's called the I don't know. It's like a little dance. Their shells tilt right and left as they're packing down the sand. And some turtle groups call it the Kemsterdley Samba or something like that.
I was going to ask you about that because I saw one. I saw one, much to my surprise, in the daytime in Pensacola. Oh, wow. When I was covering the oil spill, I saw this sea turtle dragging itself across the beach. I was like, you're not supposed to be here. It's daytime. What are you doing here?
We do get some, you know, random turtles nesting still in the mornings, but the Kemsterdleys are the ones that typically nest during the day. And I think there are more nests that are, typically occur on the west coast of Florida with the Kemps. I mean, it's still not that many. But on our beach and the ones that we monitor, the Archikar National Wildlife Refuge in Brevard County, we had, I think, 3 nests this year, which is a little unusual. And we have had one every year or every other year. So it's kind of neat. So when we hear about it, we try to race out there and put a tag in the turtle so we can identify whether it's the same one that keeps coming back or maybe some new ones. But we had at least a couple different ones this year.
And what's number 5?
Number 5 would be hawksbill. Okay. And hawksbills are typically, they nest mostly down in the Keys and in the Caribbean. They're more tropical, subtropical species. They have beautiful shells. These are the turtles that are known for their shells. This is why historically they've been used by humans for centuries. Their shell is used for as tortoise shell. So a lot of jewelry back before, we weren't allowed to use endangered species for human use and consumption. The tortoise shell was a fairly big thing, I guess, for a number of years.
How did you get into this particular field of study?
I think I got into sea turtle biology and research sort of by accident. I did my very first sea turtle internship at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida with Dave Addison, who is a character and a half. And we were out on Kuwaiten Island, which is just outside of Rookery Bay and just south of Naples Beach and north of Marcos Island, I think. It's beautiful out there. And the bugs were horrific. I don't think I have a problem now being bitten by mosquitoes because I had so many bug bites then that I just don't react to it anymore, or I just don't have any blood left. But it is a pristine island out there, and we would take a boat out and drive ATVs up and down the beach all night, had it to ourselves. And somebody was just out of college, and it was right before I was starting my master's. It was really amazing to have that level of responsibility, but also having the turtles to ourselves and knowing what the moon shifts were and the tidal shifts and it was a really cool experience. So it hooked me. It was more for the field work, I think, than anything else that sucked me in.
We'll have an upcoming episode on gopher tortoise, which are seen across Florida. What's the difference between a turtle and a tortoise? Because I think people use those terms interchangeably and they shouldn't.
Yeah, this term is one that always trips me up, mainly because I focus on the marine systems. Mm-hmm. And sea turtles are turtles, but you have turtles that are both land animals and marine species or a combination thereof. And tortoises are kind of a subgroup of, I guess, the overall turtle groups. But yeah, so gopher tortoises, they live on land.
Well, I was going to say, I know that at least once or twice a year, there's a problem where someone thinks they're rescuing a gopher tortoise by putting it in the water. And it's like, no, don't do that. That's not where they live.
we do get phone calls about gopher tortoises as well. But yeah, look at their legs. And if they have legs and claws, they're walking around and have little fingernails or something like that, that's not a sea turtle. Sea turtles have flippers and they don't walk on legs.
The males never come on land at all, right? It's only the females.
Yes, sort of. The males are, it's unusual to see them on land. In the Pacific and Hawaii, you may have some sea turtles that haul out to bask, probably to avoid predation in sharky waters out there, but also it's colder in the Pacific. The waters are typically colder than in the Atlantic. So you do get some that will bask. The males, you can't really tell a sea turtle male until it matures, unless you do some invasive techniques to figure out, you know, if they're male or female by looking at their gonads. But what happens is when they mature, they have a really long tail that all of a sudden grows. So you can tell a male by how big their tail is, but you can't tell a male until they're mature. So they're usually really big.
They're like human males. They're probably comparing how big their tails are.
Yeah. And they are big.
Do any of the males come on shore in Florida, or do we only see them? Okay. Okay.
Yes. And what is kind of cool is that they come ashore. The only place that I know of that they come ashore is on the Archie Carr National Wildlife Refuge, which we monitor. And it's mostly the green turtles that we see. And they're usually in the throes of having a mating with a female. So if the conditions are just right, and it's usually an onshore wind with a little bit of surf, they sometimes tumble ashore in the midst of mating, that we might be able to see them. And there's a woman on my project, Dean Bagley, who for a number of years has been satellite tagging the males. And so our group will go out there and kind of break up the party. And
turtle sex on the beach.
Exactly.
Come on. Everyone else was thinking it.
I'm sure it's just like Burt Lancaster and Deborah Carr.
They're just tumbling around in the surf. Yeah. But we will hold on to the males for her and kind of keep them in a box. And then she'll put a satellite tag on them to see where they go, because we really don't know that much about the males, in part because they just are harder to access.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are some predators that they have to deal with, especially the hatchling?
So the predation on sea turtles, it really varies based on what age they are, how big they are. The baby turtles, the hatchlings, while they're still in the nest, it could be any sort of land predator. It could be, we've had bobcats get into the nests, coyotes. Most common in Florida would be raccoons or fire ants, ghost crabs. And
fire ants. Yeah, that's crazy to me that fire ants get in there and eat the eggs. Wow.
Well, they eat the eggs, but they also eat the kind of go for the mucous membranes of the turtles. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's out of a horror movie of, you know, ants coming out of the eyes or the mouth or where the yolk is absorbed, kind of like where we have our belly buttons. There's something similar there that eventually will seal up. And sometimes the ants will really get in there. It's not fun to see. Other than that, armadillos, too, they're a problem. Once they emerge from the nest, it could be birds, crabs, any sort of predator, visual predator that might be on the beach. Obviously, when they get into the water, fish come into play, and a lot of the nearshore predators that you can probably think of, snapper, I think some grouper, mahi, a little bit further offshore, barracuda, a lot of fish will eat the hatchlings and post-hatchlings. Yeah. As they get bigger, sharks really are the main predator. And once the turtles have really large shells, then the only aspect that a shark can get to would be like the soft tissue, the flippers. Aside from that, humans.
Can turtles draw their flippers in, like, I guess, tortoises with their legs?
No, they've evolved not to, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. What are the historic numbers for, and I know it's going to vary by species, but when you look at our Florida turtles and in and around Florida, how are the populations now compared to when they're, you know, I'm sure their historic highs were, you know, pre-contact, but historic lows, when were that, and how are the numbers today?
Well, the lab that I manage and run has been monitoring kind of that key area of nesting on the Central Florida coast for about 40 years now. And my predecessor, Dr. Lou Earhart, started the project back in the late 70s and early 80s. And I would say at that point was probably the historic low for many of our species of turtles around Florida. Once the Endangered Species Act was put into play and the turtles were added to the endangered species list and protections were made and the Carr Refuge was established, we really started to see, within Florida at least, a stabilization of the nest numbers, and then eventually, more recently, a bit of an increase in nest numbers, at least for green turtles. Green turtles historically have been valued for their meat. They're palatable. They're still eaten in some parts of the world as a source of protein. And so back in the early 1980s, when my predecessor was first monitoring the beaches, they had maybe 0 to 40 or 50 green turtle nests in what has now become the Archie Carr National Wildlife Refuge in Brevard County. So it's really the lower 20 kilometers of the beach in Brevard County. And now we're seeing anywhere from this year, we're up to about 9,000-10,000 green turtle nests.
Oh my gosh.
But some years we've had 15,000. And so that's pretty exciting. That's great. I think the green turtles are finally slowly making a comeback. Loggerheads are, I think, fairly static. They haven't done anything too drastic over the decades. You might have year-to-year variation, but got to think about it in terms of slow science. You have to look at the trends over decades because these are long-lived and late-maturing animals.
Are there still problems with people going out and digging up the eggs to eat?
We do have issues with some nests being disturbed. Whether they're actually eating the eggs or not, I don't know. But I know over the years, I took over the lab in 2013, and every year or so, we do have an incident where we might have a suspected poaching of eggs on our beaches. We monitor about 47 kilometers of beach, and only about 20 of those kilometers are at night. So we haven't really encountered many people in action messing with nests, but it does happen, especially along the Atlantic coast, unfortunately.
You haven't heard anyone talk about how good they taste or offer recipes, I guess.
No, and I think kind of a weird fact about loggerhead eggs and sea turtle eggs is that they lack the protein that chicken eggs might have, where you crack the egg and the whites firm up. So you can't just fry up a sea turtle egg, apparently. But they were valued historically to use in baking for puddings or in cakes and things like that, just because it would add a level of moisture, maybe. And in some cultures, eggs are considered an aphrodisiac, and people put them in a shot glass and just down them. But
oh my.
Yeah.
Would the other reason for disturbing a nest be for like the exotic animal trade or something? Why else would someone fool with a nest?
I guess, yeah, possibly. I don't know that it's that easy to actually raise turtles from eggs. There's this critical window within which you can move or alter it, like alter a nest. And it's really it's a very, very quick window, hours. But beyond that, if you disturb a nest, then the embryo attaches to a membrane as it starts to grow within the egg. And if you move the eggs, that membrane embryo attachment will break and the embryo will die. So it's part of the reason why we can't relocate nests when a storm is happening, or a pending storm, or for construction or anything like that, because the eggs will likely not survive. Then you have to, if you're trying to raise and rear animals, it takes years before they probably would be of a size that would be worth anything on a trade, or, you know, their shells would be big enough if they're hawksbills or something like that. So it's difficult. And I guess that works in their favor a little bit.
When the oil spill was threatening the Panhandle beaches back in 2010, I know they relocated a lot of, I guess they relocated the hatchlings at that point, was it? What do you know how that turned out?
At the time of the oil spill, I was actually down in Miami. I was a postdoc, meaning that I was not really a full-time employee. I wasn't really much of anything other than a fly on the wall.
It was your lost years.
My lost years, yeah. My PhD lost years, felt like it. I was aware of the project, and they ended up moving, I think, a lot of the eggs over to the beach that I now run and released them there. But unfortunately, they didn't, they weren't able to tag the turtles. So we're not going to know if, you know, 25 years later, they come back to nest on the Atlantic coast of Florida, or they go back to the Panhandle. It'll be
curious. Yeah, that's amazing. Now, you've mentioned our Archie Carr National Wildlife Refuge a few times. Tell people who Archie Carr was, why that beach is named for him.
Archie Carr is, or was, the kind of the grandfather of sea turtle research. He was a professor at the University of Florida. They have a program there also called, you know, named after him. And he really was the person who brought a lot of recognition to the need to protect sea turtles and sea turtle conservation as a whole. But he was at UF at the time that my predecessor was just starting out monitoring the beaches where we now monitor. And my predecessor, Lou Earhart, otherwise known as Doc Earhart, he was trained as a small mammal researcher. And so he was into beach mice and things, you know, that had four legs and furriness and stuff like that. And he was doing some of the contracts for Kennedy Space Center in advance of the launch pads, I think, for the space shuttle program, doing some of the environmental assessments. And Dr. Archie Carr asked him to check out the beaches to the south because they had been doing aerial surveys and noticed that there seemed to be quite a few turtle crawls in the area. So that pretty much changed the trajectory of my predecessor's career, and ultimately is probably why I'm now actually, I have a job.
And he was married. He was married to Marjorie Harris Carr, who helped to stop the Cross Florida barge canal. It's just, I think it's kind of neat that you have this married couple and there are two distinct physical features in Florida that are named for them, the Archie Carr National Wildlife Refuge and then the Marjorie Harris Carr Greenway, which is what they did with the remainder of the canal.
Well, the Archie Carr National Wildlife Refuge is also one of very, very few U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service refuges named after a person as well. I think Ding Darling is another one in the state of Florida, but the data that my predecessor and the lab collected were actually used by a variety of entities, including U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to establish the Carr Refuge back in the late 1980s and formally by 1991, I think.
If folks want to go through the archive, our bonus episode on Vero Beach talks more about the Archie Carr National Wildlife Refuge, and you're there in Brevard County. That's Brevard County. So we do talk more about sea turtles in that episode for an additional deep dive and some activities that visitors and residents alike can get involved in with turtle excavations and nests and advocacy and that sort of thing. If someone finds, I'm walking on the beach or I'm out fishing and I see an injured sea turtle, it's got a hook in it, it's bleeding, it's clearly disoriented, and this has happened to me, it's flopping around in the surf and can't get its bearings, what should I do?
Ideally, call the state sea turtle stranding hotline and take pictures of it just to have in case they need anything. Get a location and relay that information to the hotline. Sometimes you might have to leave a message, but make sure you leave your cell phone number, a clear indication of where the animal is, if it's alive or dead, and take some pictures just as backup in case it gets washed back out.
If folks want to go out and see a sea turtle perhaps laying its eggs, are there any programs they can volunteer for to do that?
There are a number of programs up and down the Florida coasts. It really varies based on where you are, but we also have a number of programs, especially on the Atlantic coast, that offer turtle walks during the peak of the season. It's usually June and July. And then at the end of the season, when the hatchlings are starting to emerge, they do turtle digs, where they will excavate a hatched nest a few days after it has hatched. And you can maybe, if you're lucky, see some hatchlings that might have been trapped in the nest. So it's possible that you can go out with a group for a guided tour and walk to see turtles nesting, mostly loggerheads, and or see some hatchlings. Aside from that, there are a number of programs. A lot of them are on the Atlantic coast, and some are rehabilitation programs that do accept volunteers. It just would be a matter of looking at your local community and maybe looking at some of the local groups to see who's in the area.
I know here on Amelia Island, that is one of the hottest volunteer opportunities going, is the morning turtle walk group. They turn more people away than they're able to accept into the program. Those folks who go out, like you say, 5-6 o'clock in the morning and look for the nests. Again, in that Vero Beach bonus episode, coastal-connections.org in Brevard County. Vero Beach is an organization that allows visitors to come in and participate in some of their sort of things. But yeah, up and down everywhere. If turtle walks and volunteering is something you're interested in doing, you don't have to look far because a lot of people want to participate in those sort of activities, and they're everywhere, that turtle's nest.
Coastal Connections is a great program, and it's run by a former master student of mine, Kendra Cope.
Oh, yeah.
I just think it's so cool that, you know, a lot of endangered species you never see. Panthers, for instance, you will hardly ever see, but there are some endangered species in Florida that, you know, they're almost in your backyard, manatees being one and sea turtle being another example.
Sea turtles are just so neat in some ways because they are living dinosaurs. They've been around in their modern kind of forms for over 110 million years, something like that. So our interns are experiencing dinosaur breath if they're up close to putting a tag on them or something like that. It's just kind of neat to think about.
Because they can brag, I had sand flung on me by a dinosaur.
Mm-hmm. As far as threats go, I'm imagining water pollution, development are the biggies.
Yes. In Florida, at least because of sea turtles and some other and manatees, a lot of the fishing activity is heavily regulated. So some of the higher threat fishing gears and types of fishing activity are mostly found offshore, which is good for our turtles. Harmful algal blooms have kind of secondary effects on food availability for the turtles. They're air breathers. So you do have some respiratory issues with some types of algal blooms. Development, loss of shoreline, loss of habitat, seawalls. I could go on.
Yeah. What effect is climate change having on them? I can imagine higher temperatures are not great for them.
Yeah, we're still figuring out the long-term impacts of climate change. And it's kind of like this slow progression that we're still needing probably more and more data, but it likely will affect sex ratios. Sea turtles.
Really?
Yes, the sex of a sea turtle is determined by the temperature at which they develop as an embryo. So if you have nests that at the surface of the nest, you might have hotter temperatures because it's closer to the surface of the beach versus the bottom of the nest. And the warmer temperatures, there's kind of a temperature threshold above which all the eggs will develop into females, and below which they'll develop into males. So the sex ratios of turtles emerging from our beaches, especially in southeast Florida, it's mostly female at this point. But as you go north, you have more turtles, or if we have a relatively cool rainy season, that's another aspect that might that might end up changing the sex ratios or balancing them out a little bit. Alternatively, storm events, if we're getting more and more frequent, stronger and stronger storms, we're going to have more beach erosion, more nest loss. This is especially true for green turtles because they nest a little bit later in the season than loggerheads. So what we're seeing in our beaches is that if we have a green turtle year that is relatively high, and we get a storm event that happens while they're still nesting, we're going to get a lot of nest loss. Loggerheads may have already hatched out most of their nests, so the loggerhead nest loss is a little bit less. But so green turtles might be in the target for more active storm seasons. And beyond that, changes to the ocean currents. And when those little hatchlings, emerge from their nests and they might hook up with ocean currents, if those currents slow down or they go different places, we may have interesting results as those turtles either may or may not be able to make it back to the coastal habitats as larger juveniles, or we don't really know what the impact of that might be.
Interesting, because I know there's been some talk about the Gulf Stream possibly being changed by climate change. How important is the Gulf Stream for sea turtles? Is that part of their lost year?
I think it's incredibly important. I think what we're seeing is that a lot of the turtles that emerge from Florida beaches, and that's about 90% of all of the nesting in the North Atlantic, that those little hatchlings are going to encounter the Gulf Stream as they're going through their frenzy period and moving offshore. And so the Gulf Stream really works as an early dispersal method for them. It's like a highway of sorts, and it gets them moving into what's called the North Atlantic Subtropical Gyre, which is a big circle of currents that makes up the better part of the Atlantic. And the western current is the Gulf Stream. And then it kind of gets past North Carolina and heads to the east more and more towards Europe and the Azores. And that's the North Atlantic current. And then it heads south by the Azores along the coast of Africa as the Canary current through the Canary Islands. And then back across towards the Caribbean and eventually makes its way into the Gulf Stream again as the North Equatorial Current. That acts as a playpen, kind of the boundaries for little turtles during their lost years. And some might ride that current around in a big circle, but some of the work that my lab is doing, satellite tagging and tracking the sea turtle lost years, we're showing that they're going into the Sargasso Sea, which is in the middle of that gyre and kind of over towards the western side near Bermuda and our neck of the woods.
Now, we would be remiss if we didn't ask you about plastics. A lot of people were raising red flags about that 10, 20 years ago. Is it still a continuing problem, or have people learned their lesson about that?
It's a continuing issue. The plastics are persistent. So even plastics that were in the oceans 20 or 30 years ago might still be there. We have had some, you know, changes in human behavior and habitat or habits based on that viral video that went out of the straw that somebody pulled out of a sea turtle nose and the turtle was flinching, which is really difficult to watch.
Yeah.
But that's just one part of a much larger problem. And the offshore work that my lab does, we do go offshore and focus on habitats that we know that the little lost year turtles are found within, including that floating mass of sargassum. It's a brown algae that floats at the surface that make up those weed lines that fishermen like to go out and target to catch mahi and other sport fish. And we see a lot of plastics in there, and the little turtles that we catch, we collect poop samples if they are gracious enough to give us a poop sample. And often we will see chunks of plastic within those samples. So it is a problem. I know that some washbacks that we get up in Volusia County, there's been some work done by some folks at FIT and elsewhere that have looked at the plastic ingestion by these like really small, I would say saucer size, teacup saucer size turtles. And they are already ingesting plastic at that small stage and age.
Wow.
So it is a problem.
Dr. Kate Mansfield, who runs the UCF Marine Turtle Research Group, has been our guest. Kate, thank you so much for your time. The cat in the background of your Zoom is telling us mom spent enough time talking to Welcome to Florida and needs more attention. So we can get a hint and we'll say goodbye for today.
Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you very much. Very fun.
Like we were talking about recently with manatees and, you know, back in the archives with the panthers, again, sea turtles, one of those animals that without which Florida's just not Florida. And, you know, it is our obligation, in my opinion, to protect them. And when Kate talks about how reliant those populations are on Florida, when you're talking about 70, 80, 90%, hey, if we drop the ball on this, it's not like we just drop the ball for Florida. We drop the ball for the world.
Yeah, it's bad for the whole globe if we mess that up. And for oceans all over the place, because they play such a crucial role in the life of our oceans that we, you know, we ourselves depend on.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you talk about the plastics, and there's so much research now about how there's more plastic material on Earth than living material or in the oceans. And, you know, even in the baby turtles, you see it and you get offshore. Now, I forget what episode it was, maybe the Gulf episode. We were talking about ghost tackle with some of these, you know, 2-3 mile long trawling fishing nets when they get disconnected or broken. And then they're just out there to catch, you know, turtles by the flipper or the gill, and then they get caught in that kind of stuff and can't free themselves and starve. So, you know, man's role with the turtles, like all these other species, is direct. And again, you know, it ties back to how we started this episode with, you know, when you make those personal connections to nature, like you and I have been fortunate enough to do. I've been fortunate enough to see a nesting sea turtle here on Amelia Island. It's been about 5 years. I haven't seen one since. I did pull a couple of dead turtles out of the surf in 2020, and that's a heartbreaking experience. Yeah. But when you make that personal connection and you're able to feel that intimately, it changes your outlook and the actions you're willing to take and the sacrifices you're willing to make and just generally the behaviors you're willing to engage in or not to make sure that you can either have or not have those experiences again in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I mean, you know, just in general, don't be a jerk to nature. I mean, I guess that's kind of the bottom line. You know, if you live on the beach, turn your lights off. Don't leave your furniture out where the sea turtles can get tangled up in it during turtle nesting season. I mean, it's just real basic stuff. And you might be rewarded by seeing one of these magnificent creatures come up and lay eggs, because it's quite a moving sight.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.